This is Karis Alexander at Big Fish Radio. We look forward to a wonderful show for you today. We have Peter Canova, who's going to be calling in shortly, and he's going to be talking to us regarding his book, Pope Annalisa and the First Souls, Lost Genesis. So we look forward to having him on board here. You know, it's very interesting how Source works. You know, today is Mother's Day, and this new book that Peter has put together is a wonderful book in that, well, how can I say, it really touches on the feminine aspect of our spirit self, and he's going to be sharing a lot with us on with regards to how to integrate more of who we are with what it is that we are doing in this world. And but he's actually done a lot of research. He's quite thorough in terms of what he his background and everything. So I really look forward to having him on the show. So I'm just going to give you a little background on Peter here before he comes onto the show. And he, basically at the age of 23, he first realized his ability to do what we call intuitive medical readings, and I guess he'll explain a little bit about that. He was also very involved in what is called remote viewing, psychokinesis, and other psychic phenomena. And this led him to a conviction that all of humanity and all of life is basically interconnected at an unseen level. As he traveled in four different continents for his work, he did a variety of. He actually met a variety of spiritual figures, entered his life as he was going along in his journey, and those unsolicited spiritual figures basically reaffirmed to him his beliefs about seeing the interconnectedness in the at an unseen level. Peter started writing in earnest after he stopped working for 8 months to take care of his wife, who had been battling cancer. And so he combined his love of writing with his spiritual background and his travel to produce a fictional work entitled The First Souls Trilogy. Now, oh, here he is.
I am here.
Hi there. Peter, you
Hello,
there?
Hello, Karis. Yes,
great,
I'm here.
Thanks.
How are you?
Super. Oh, I'm great. I was just doing your overview and talking to our listeners here. So I'm just going to continue that, and then we can delve into the questions. Okay? How's that?
That'll be great.
Super. So Peter basically combined his love for writing with his spiritual background and his travels to produce a fictional work entitled The First Souls Trilogy. The trilogy concerns the first fall of spirit into material existence as told through the lives of characters who incarnated or appear over different epochs of history. Pope Annalisa is the first book where he tells of an African nun who becomes the first female pope, believe that, in a near future world headed for self-destruction. Now, the overarching theme of Pope Annalisa and the trilogy deals with the origin, destiny, and purpose of humanity, and this is really key. It concerns spirit transcending religion, the lost mystical traditions of early Christianity, the suppressed role of women in spiritual history, and the intersection of modern science and ancient mysticism. And basically, what happens is that it poses a startling new perspective, or gives us a new perspective, on the true nature of reality. Now, Peter, he doesn't look that old in his picture, but he has had 25 years of research behind him in both mainstream and alternative religious and spiritual studies, with a particular interest in early Christianity. So Pope Annalisa, his newest book, is a combination of his research and information channeled in his own meditations. So Peter, without further ado, maybe you can give us a little bit of background going back to your mystical experiences, because I think that that's usually for a lot of us, and a lot of the authors that I have on the show, I always ask them to sort of give us a little overview on in terms of what their spiritual awakening and ascension process was and how it sort of directed them in terms of the work that they're currently doing. So maybe you can shed some light on that, and then we can delve a little bit more into your work.
Sure. I guess you could say that as a teenager, I was one of those teenagers who always sort of felt alienated from his surroundings. I always felt there was kind of something either weird about the world or about myself, that something wasn't really quite right. So I suppose you could say from an early age I was kind of a seeker. And I think everybody, to some extent, experiences those feelings in their life. Some of them dismiss them pretty quick. Some of them, maybe like myself, obsess on them a little bit too much, and they kind of go on to do a little bit of self-exploration. And I was in my early 20s, I believe, when this was back in the 1970s. Now I'm really dating myself. And I saw an advertisement in a paper for a course called Silva Mind Control. And it sounds kind of ominous, but it was actually a pretty neat course where they taught people to develop their intuitive abilities. Back in those days, they would call it psychic perception or ESP. And I attended the course in the Boston area, and it was kind of interesting. It was about a week long, but on the last day, they did intuitive medical readings where you would have two people that would go off in pairs kind of in a corner. One of them would have an index card, and the index card would have the information about a certain individual, because they encouraged everybody who was going through the course to bring in these index cards, so they had a huge resource file of them. They really graduated a lot of people through this course. And the person who had the card would simply be allowed to tell you the name, age, and address that was on the card, nothing more. They couldn't give you any hints or prompts or whatever. And then the person opposite them would have to go into a meditative state and kind of describe what they saw. Well, I remember very clearly, like it was yesterday, the very first case that I did. I was an elderly gentleman in Miami, and I saw immediately, I saw an outline or an image of his body, and I was attracted to the heart area, and it looked like the heart was kind of tilted at a funny angle, causing the aorta to be pinched. And I said, I think the gentleman has a blockage in his aorta. And they said, well, that's correct. What else can you tell us? And I saw something metallic down at the bottom quadrant of his heart. And I said, well, I think he had a pacemaker installed because I see something metallic in there. And they said, that's correct. And then they asked me, what year was the pacemaker installed? So I saw the hands of a clock moving around kind of wildly, and then all of a sudden it stopped dead at 10 o'clock, which in my mind meant 10 years earlier. Now, this was 1975, so I said, I think he had the pacemaker installed in 1965, and that was the information on the card. I went on to do a number of more cases quite accurately, and then I went home that night, and I remember really probably having the best sleep I'd ever had in my life, because I felt really at peace. And I had this thought, this flash came to me that night, that we are all connected at an unseen level, because there's no other way that I could have known this information consistently time after time if that were not the case. And I felt this connectedness in such a way that it was a very peaceful, very secure, and very relaxing feeling that I had never had in my life before, because I had really touched that universal energy that runs through all of us and that contains that information with which we can help one another. So I proceeded to go on, and before I knew it, I was a college student at the time, living in a working class area in Boston. I had people like lined up outside my door for medical readings, and I'd give them some readings and send them off to the doctor. I never charged for it, but I just did that at the time. And then later on, I started traveling abroad when I left college, and I got a job. I was in import-export and overseas construction and finance, different jobs at that time. And it seemed like everywhere I went, whether I was in Africa or whether I was in Thailand, I would have people approach me. I mean, just out of the clear blue. And I remember I was walking in the streets in Thailand, and I had an Indian gentleman kind of looking very much like what you'd expect a yogi to look like, almost kind of a stereotype, just walk up and look me right in the face. They said, oh, you're the boy that knows things. And I said, what do you mean? And then we started talking, and it's like he knew a lot about me, and he said, well, you're on a path. And we talked about some different things. But this was kind of consistent phenomena that I kept running into people like this no matter where I go, shamans in the bush country of Africa and everything else. I guess it's part of the law of attraction. At that time, I was really growing spiritually, and these people would come into my life to help me and to reaffirm. So, Karis, I guess the biggest thing I could say out of that whole experience is I probably made the graduation from faith to knowledge. And that's a big theme in Pope Annalisa, is how we graduate from faith in things to knowledge of things, rather than saying that, you know, I have faith in spirit or I have faith in God, which is a belief that we basically take on and adopt from things that we've been told. When you actually have a direct experience of something, you now pass beyond the veil of faith into knowledge because you've really experienced it and you know it's there and it's yours and it's part of you.
Yeah, and I really appreciate the fact that you're able to make that distinction and you comprehend that on probably a very cellular level. Because, yes, we live in a physical world system where we are given a lot of information, and, you know, faith sort of is in that, you know, is encompassed in that information that we're given. You know, we develop our faith or beliefs out of that information. And one of, you know, I understand, you know, a lot of people get this very intellectually, and it's to the point now where for a lot of people it becomes redundant. But until they make the next step to actually experiencing it as knowledge and owning it within themselves, or having the experience of it as knowledge, then you haven't really made the integration, right?
So, well, yes, because think about it for a second. Faith really means that you don't know for sure, but you're kind of taking somebody else's opinion or kind of adopting the belief of another person or another body of dogmas or whatever. But it's really not your own until you've actually gone through it. And you can say, I've been there, I've seen it, I can take that whole vision back with me. And that is a quantum leap. It's really a quantum leap. And incidentally, I'm not putting faith down. We grow by stepping stones, and I certainly think faith is an important stepping stone. So I don't want the listeners to think that I'm kind of putting down anybody's faith. I operate on faith still in things that I'm not completely sure about. But faith is a stepping stone, and hopefully we can, you know, graduate to a higher level. And I think that next grade up would certainly be actually having direct experience of things, which leads you to have direct knowledge of it.
Yes, and that's, I believe, the next stage that we're in, right? Would you agree? We're moving into the stage of comprehending or having more of an experience of what it is to be a spirit or consciousness in this physical being, right?
I think more people are having those experiences.
Yes.
If you take a look at our history, at least in the United States, in the last couple of decades, we went from probably no discussion or consciousness around these issues and around spiritual matters to various phases from the kind of, I guess, amorphous spirituality in the hippie generation to the New Age. And again, these were all laying foundations and stepping stones, I think. And again, a lot of that was based on wisdom that was coming in from the Eastern countries. And we tended to rely at that time on a lot of gurus, the Beatles, if you think of the Beatles and the Maharaji or their spiritual teacher. But I think now we are going into a period of time where I see more people having direct spiritual experiences, having those glimpses or moments of personal enlightenment.
Yes, beautiful, beautiful. So, now, let's delve into the book here. This is a new book for you, and why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the successes that you're having so far? I mean, tell us a little bit about the awards that you've already garnered regarding this book, and it's not even being mass-produced yet. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Actually, it's been out on a paperback version on Amazon.com, which I put out there as a test market for about a year or so. And I got some very nice reviews. You can read them on Amazon if you go there. But the actual hardcover publication doesn't happen until June 1st. But we sent out advanced copies to various book competitions and various reviewers in order to try and get a little bit of advanced buzz on the book or a little bit of a feel for how the book might fare in the marketplace. The first two contests that it was entered in were the Nautilus Awards and the Independent Publishers Awards, which is also called the IPPY, I-P-P-Y Awards. The Nautilus Awards was a particularly rigorous competition because you have to go through three layers of judges, three panels of judges, all across the country, and you have to pass through each panel by a majority vote. And apparently, from what I've told, Pope Annalisa went through the three judging panels with unanimous votes by all the judges at each level, and they awarded it the highest marks they've given a book in years. It won two silver medals in different categories in spirituality and visionary fiction, and then it went on to win the gold medal in visionary fiction. The second award, the IPPY Award, bills itself as the world's largest book award, and I guess that's by virtue of the sheer volume of entries they have, which numbers close to 4,000. And I just learned about 2 days ago that Pope Annalisa won the IPPY Award. I'm waiting to hear whether it's a gold, silver, or bronze. But in any case, it has won a very high award over there. So the first two contests the book was entered in, it was able to take home some. It was able to go right up to the top, which was really gratifying because, you know, when you're a writer, it's kind of a lonely profession. You kind of sit here and write things that are important to you and that are on your mind, but you never really know if they're going to have any meaning to anybody else. And, of course, at the end of the day, I think that's what every writer really desires. We desire to communicate with other people and also to move other people with an emotional experience. I think, for me, that's one of the most important things about writing. If I can connect with my readers emotionally and there's something that really moves them in a profound way about the book, then I know I've done my job. And I think the interesting thing about Pope Annalisa is it's really having broad appeal. It's really two stories in Pope Annalisa. One is a thriller about an African nun who starts performing these miraculous healings in Nigeria, and she comes under suspicion of the church because she's doing this sort of outside of the authority of the church, and they don't like that. And she's also upsetting the apple cart in a country which is half Muslim and half Christian, the most populous country in Africa. And it's always been a flashpoint between the two worldviews of the two religions. And since some of the Muslims are converting because of her healings, she's got the militant terrorist population down there up in arms, and she also has the hierarchy of the Catholic Church on her. But she goes on to, through a series of circumstances, which you'll have to read in the book because I really don't want to give it away, but through some really profound circumstances, she ends up being taken into the church as a cardinal and ultimately becomes the pope, and then starts really kind of reversing 2,000 years of Christian and Catholic tradition as the world starts to go to war and nuclear conflagration is just around the corner. So everyone's wondering at this point, well, gee, is she a force for good or evil? Is she the, you know, cure or the cause of the of this harsh new world? But then the parallel story, the second story, is really the spiritual part, which speaks to a lost tradition that was once strong or even prevalent among ancient Christians and Jews, and it was a universal spiritual wisdom. It was really feminine in character, and it was much more in rhythm and nature than the rather convoluted and sophisticated dogmas that we ended up with in Christianity. And it was really found in pretty much all ancient cultures and religion, even Christianity and Judaism, before it was destroyed by the hierarchies. And it posed a very different view of human beings as co-participants or even co-creators of a divine evolutionary process, rather than these kind of wayward little sinners that are forever trying to atone for their original sin. So it's some people love it just for the, you know, page-turning aspect of the story, the mystery and the thrill. Other people go right for the spiritual content. So it seems to appeal to two very diverse types of markets, and that's what I was trying to do when I wrote the book. It was a very delicate balancing act to be able to write that book with a sort of two-sided aspect to it without one side becoming so prevalent over the other that it killed the story.
Right. No, that's wonderful. So why don't you just give back up a little bit and tell us, what is the First Souls Trilogy?
Sure. The First Souls Trilogy, I think, as you touched upon in your introduction, it's an epic saga about the first spirits to enter materiality and their search for their way back to their spiritual home. The trilogy follows their incarnations over different eras of human history, and these incarnations encompass both historical and fictional characters. But as you said, the trilogy, ultimately, it's really about the origin, destiny, and purpose of humanity that's revealed through the lives and the circumstances of the characters in the trilogy. And the main theme would really be the evolution of human consciousness towards a transcendent perception of being in reality beyond what we have been taught is reality. There's something in this ancient tradition that always described the world as an illusion. Very much like if you think of the movie The Matrix, that, of course, the main task of the characters in The Matrix was to unplug from the computer that was essentially controlling their existence and creating the reality, the illusion of reality. And those of them who became enlightened were able to unplug from the mainframe and see reality for what it truly was, how it was really meant to be, without these intermediary forces deviating us on false paths. And that's very much what the ancient tradition that I've been speaking of was really all about. It was about cutting through that veil of illusion and helping people to gain these moments of enlightenment that would show them that what was really behind what we take for reality. So the First Souls is really watching these characters progress over these different epochs of history in order to grow and in order to reach that remembrance of what their true spiritual home was so that they can work their way back to the place from which we devolved.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So what makes Pope Annalisa different from similar thrillers?
I think the main thing that distinguishes the book from your average commercial thriller is that the solution to all these difficult problems and all these crises in the book is not your typical social, economic, or political or military solution. The solutions at the end all come from a spiritual perspective, and the problems are overcome, and the enlightenment is gained from reaching a spiritual plateau of knowledge and awareness that allows the characters in the book to exert a control over their world rather than having the mass mind thought of this world control them. So the solutions ultimately to the plot lines and to the dilemmas and all the conflicts in the book are spiritual solutions. Very few books nowadays, at least in fictional form, I think, could really say the same thing.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And you know, your book, it seems very timely in what you're just describing, because a lot of what the book references is the time that we live in right now. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
You talk about a period 20 years from now, but a lot of what I'm reading in your book, it sounds like what we're going through as a human species right now.
Well, it was really designed that way because in the plot of the book, America and Iran are closing in on a nuclear confrontation. The issue between the Islamic world and the Western world is very much a part of the backdrop of this. The scarcity that we're heading towards in terms of natural resources of oil and water and so forth are all a part of this. So it was written in the near future, but it deals with issues that we're facing today. And the solutions to those issues really take on kind of a classic universal aspect. It's really something that's applicable to human dilemmas in any time and in any place. So, yes, it really is timely. And I think what it's pointing towards is we have so many issues that concern us nowadays. And this is pointing towards a spiritual solution that is not just totally idealistic and unrealistic. I think it points to a whole set of circumstances that we have within our grasp to obtain, especially with the fact that so many people are going through a quickening or a heightening of their consciousness, and that if we really had enough people, and it's kind of like the 100 monkeys theory, I really believe if enough people came to a certain realization about our real place as human beings in the world and what we can do to help co-evolve this planet, that if we were in that high spiritual place at the same time, I believe at that point that consciousness catches on like wildfire, and you kind of tip the critical mass we need to really begin to, you know, transform ourselves and transform the planet, transform our attitudes, transform our beliefs, transform our notions about what reality and matter and spirit and all these other things really are. And in gaining those that knowledge and then that enlightenment, we really are able to transform our outer circumstances and the whole course of life on this planet.
Yeah, I have a couple of comments here in the chat room, and one person saying that I really love the idea of a woman pope, not because of some woman's rights or attitude, but because I believe spirituality is beyond gender. Yeah.
Yes, so, and your listener is absolutely right about that. God does not have express himself, herself, itself in sexes like we do in material existence. However, God does express itself in varying forms of energy, different vibrations of energy that we can call masculine and feminine, that kind of form the polarity and form the heat and the friction that really created the physical processes of this world and the spiritual energies and back of those processes. And one of the reasons that I made the character a female is because I fully believe that the consciousness that we're seeing now, the raising of consciousness, has a distinctly feminine character to it. And it's not surprising to me because at one time, the feminine aspect of spirituality was very well recognized, and it was the more common form of worship with the goddess and the great mother. Then, of course, we won't go into all the where's and why for us, but the world took a big swing over to a patriarchal dominance, a male dominance that we've had for several thousand years now that's pretty much colored everything we've done. And I see the rising consciousness now coming in the form of a feminine energy. And this is not feminism. You know, we're not talking about political feminism, and we're not talking about radical feminism, which is, you know, women rising up to throw off the yoke of thousands of years of male oppression and things like that. And those things are, you know, just some outer manifestations. What I'm really talking about is we're learning to recapture feminine values that were once very much part of our life in terms of creativity, intuition, heartfelt thinking, as opposed to logical, mind-centered, linear-type thinking, which is more characteristic of the male energy. So when we talk about male and female in the book, we're really talking about representations of these energies, which hopefully the idea is not for one to gain dominance over the other, but to come into a balance, and therefore we become whole human beings. If we were able to use all these faculties, both the male and the female faculties, simultaneously in our lives, we would be much more whole and complete human beings, and I think our lives would be much more fulfilled than what a lot of us are experiencing now, because we're so fragmented by being, you know, much too strong on one side and much too weak on the other. And I think a lot of people in what you might call, well, you know, the New Age world or the spiritual movement, they, in order to change their lives, we've been taught a lot, well, you know, you take something and you visualize it in your mind, and then you use affirmations, and you just learn how to believe it, and that's how you change your world. It doesn't quite work like that, and a lot of people don't get the results that way, because that's a kind of male-oriented side of the equation. The male-oriented side of the equation is, I'll use my logical mind to identify a goal that I want to achieve, and then I'll formulate the language and the actions around that thought and you know, turn my energies towards it. But the female side of the equation, the thing that is really going to make that happen in your life is desire. It's love. It's desire. It's pure emotion that is harnessed towards that goal. So that you could say that the male contribution towards achieving our aims is the guidance system of a rocket. The female contribution is the actual fuel itself. It's that heartfelt desire and that creative urge to you know, use our natural creative power and express ourselves. And the two of those things together is what really gets us results in life.
Right. That's great. I have a comment here. Yes, little known but a fact, the Cherokee people are traced are traced, once traced their lineage through the women. That's interesting. And then I have another comment here. Until the European views of those who could trace ancestry forced them to change their natural lifestyle and culture. Okay. Thanks for your comments in the chat room there. So why don't you give us a little bit of background in terms of why you chose an African female? Because you have, obviously, you spent a lot of time in Nigeria. Why don't you give us a little bit of a background on that? Because I think that that's very interesting.
Yeah, well, the two are tied in together. So let me talk about the setting and let me talk about the female figure. What? Yes, I did live in Nigeria for several years. And one of the reasons I chose Nigeria as a place where much of the action in the book happens, at least the first part of the book, is that it is the most populous country in Africa. And one of the things that I was, one of the plot lines of the book is the how this whole issue between the West and Islamic fundamentalism is going to play out. And of course, Nigeria being almost evenly divided between the two religions has always been kind of the front lines, the battle lines between them. So it seemed like a very logical place in order to set the book. But it wasn't the only reason. I also wanted to have it in Africa because in Africa, besides Islam and Christianity, you still have a lot of natural religion over there, religion based on nature, shamanism, you could call it. There are a lot of bush doctors still. Even people who profess to be Christian and Islamic will still very often fall back on the precepts of nature religion. And one of the things that Annalisa, the main character in the book, does is her brand of a feminine-oriented spirituality is much more in tune with the pulses and the rhythms of Mother Earth, and it's more of a simple, direct, straightforward spiritual revelation as opposed to all the elaborate intellectual dogmatic structures that the Catholic Church has built over the years, all these sophisticated dogmas, which really most people don't get. I mean, the average Catholic, the average Christian, or even the average person would not really understand. It would be like a remote intellectual exercise for them to sift through all these things that the Catholic Church has developed as a superstructure between them and God. So Annalisa takes a more direct route, and a more direct route through this feminine, this feminine-oriented natural road of spirit to come to the understandings that she has, and this is something that is tied in actually, and part of the book is the revelation of a real ancient spiritual tradition that we found out about that it could have been completely lost. A lot of light was shed on it when in 1945 they discovered an Arab peasant looking for fertilizer, went into some caves, and he discovered these ancient Coptic documents that turned out to be lost Christian gospels. And these gospels shed a very, very different light on the nature of early Christianity and what it was about. And it was a much more feminine orientation that you see in these lost gospels where, for instance, the main disciple in these, it shows to be Mary Magdalene. Mary Magdalene was the disciple who most clearly understood Jesus' secret, high esoteric teachings. And in fact, St. Peter, who the Church of Rome was built on, was depicted in these Gospels as not really getting it. He was pretty clueless. He was probably one of the dumber disciples in terms of his deeper understanding. So everything in these Gospels really turned our traditional notions of Christianity on their head, with diametrical opposite presentations of what the Christian story was. These are called Gnostic Gospels, G-N-O-S-T-I-C, and the Gnostics, that comes from the Greek word to know, and Gnostics were Christian mystics who were very strong and very prevalent in the early Christian church, who used their meditative and spiritual abilities to penetrate the higher realms and bring back information to in the forms of myths and other stories and gospels that they told, to really shed light on what reality was, where we came from, where we're going, why we're here, and what the real nature of the world is. And some of these revelations that they brought back were really startling. I mean, to the point where I could tick off a whole list of modern theories from quantum physics and advanced theoretical science that were predicted 2,000 years before by the Gnostics. Just a couple of examples. The Gnostics said that our universe was emanated or projected from a series of pre-existing universes. Well, that's exactly what the parallel universe theory says, that we came from and we live side by side with other dimensions.
Right.
They said that matter was nothing more than a gross crystallized form of higher energy. Well, that's exactly what Einstein's theory of relativity says, E equals MC squared, that matter and energy are interchangeable. They also talked about the fact that the world that as we see it was actually a projection of another reality, so that what we actually think, what we take for reality and what we actually see is more like a representation of a truer world. Well, that's exactly what fractals and the holographic universe theory says, which is that we are essentially projected parts of a deeper whole. So, you know, it goes on and on. The Big Bang being a contraction of 10 dimensions to down to 3, that's exactly what they said. The Gnostics said the material universe was expelled from 10 or more higher dimensions. It's just really incredible that they were able to use their subjective spiritual abilities to bring back the same information that modern objective science is now discovering with their instruments and theories.
But would you say that maybe they just took the information from the Gnostic texts and just made it into their own language for our time? Or
you mean are you talking about scientists or who
well, you're doing a comparison between what you found in the ancient Gnostic texts, is that correct? And
yes.
And referencing it to our modern day scientific explanation for the same thing, is that correct?
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, you, obviously, the Gnostics would not be using terms like parallel universe theory, Big Bang, and so forth.
Wondering if that's the language for our day. You know, I mean, could they have just taken this information and this Gnostic information and just translated it into their own theories?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could say that the ancient mystics were working on a parallel course with science, making
yes.
the same discoveries, but obviously because of the gap in terms of cultures, times, 2,000 years apart and so forth, the Gnostics were describing these similar theories or patterns in the language and the cultural norms of their day. Obviously, they didn't have the scientific instruments and they didn't have the technological terms that we've developed now, but if you look at the core of what they're saying, they so closely parallel what these modern scientific theories are saying that you can have little doubt that they're saying the same thing.
Right. Okay. So listen, I have a question here. Are the Gnostic texts the same as the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Not quite.
The
Gnostic Gospels, also called the Nag Hammadi Gospels, because that's
yes.
that's the area where they were found by in Egypt. They are. The Gnostic Gospels are both Christian and pre-Christian because the Gnostics predated Christianity. The Gnostics were part of this universal spiritual tradition as I described it, and according to the Gnostic tradition, God sends a series of revealers through the course of history in order to sort of keep us on our spiritual track so we don't get so lost in materiality that we can never find our way out again and we lose all concept of our spiritual nature and where we came from, and that Jesus was the highest expression of that Redeemer knowledge that appeared in his era. So when Jesus came along, the Gnostics readily embraced the Christian story. And they expressed it in terms of the ancient spiritual tradition. Now the Dead Sea Scrolls were more Jewish in character, and they really were the development of a Jewish sect called the Zadokites, and they had broken off from the temple in Jerusalem because they felt that the high priests were usurpers, and they were sort of like the hippies of their day. They went out to these caves and cliffs above the Dead Sea and developed their teachings there, and they were the first ones who brought forth the concept of a Messiah who was going to come to rescue Israel. Their concept of a Messiah was somewhat political. They were looking, actually it was kind of split. Some of them looked for kind of a political Messiah, others were looking for a spiritual Messiah. Many people have said that Jesus was probably derived from this Essene community. I'm a little skeptical about that. I know that's kind of popular in spiritual circles nowadays that Jesus was an Essene, but if you really take a very close look at the Dead Sea Scrolls and what Jesus was saying, there's some pretty large discrepancies there. He may have had something to do with them, but I don't actually believe that he was a member of the community. But to answer your question very simply, the Dead Sea Scrolls really were more Jewish in character. The Nag Hammadi find was really more Christian in character.
Okay, great. Now, this, something I really liked that I was reading here that you had said, that humans are spiritual vibrations slowed down and condensed into seemingly solid forms, like holographic representations of the true underlying reality. But just as a holographic program can be deceptively real, remember the Star Trek holodeck, the spirit essence became overwhelmed by the denseness of materiality. In a kind of amnesia, spirit began to identify with the material body through the agent of free will and forgot its divine origin. I talk about this all the time, so I love that when I read that.
Well, you know, and that wasn't just something that came from the ancient spiritual tradition or the Gnostics. It was even Edgar Cayce, who many people may be familiar with his name, lived in the 1930s, was one of the greatest psychics of our time. In his readings about history and spirit, Edgar Cayce pretty much told the same story, which is a story of spirit falling into material existence and essentially kind of a symbiotic relationship with an animal body. Humans are, a human being is a composite of an animal body and a spiritual energy. And yet, in the material plane of existence, the pull of matter, like gravity, is so strong that after a while, the spirit consciousness began to identify with the boundaries of its skin and began to and really forgot its spiritual origin and its spiritual nature. And the Greeks had, and the Gnostics had an ancient Greek term called anamnesis, which was the opposite of amnesia. Anamnesis meant remembering. So the goal of these mystics was really remembrance, because the idea is that because we are part of the universal vibration of God, we are parts of God's divine energy in material form. We know all there really is to know somewhere deep inside us. That consciousness that of spirit is locked deep inside each of us. And enlightenment really is not so much learning, but it's remembering what we already know.
Exactly. No, that's beautiful. Thanks for sharing that. So what is the primary message you're trying to convey to your readers in your book? You're going to sum it all up.
Yeah. Well, I think that we touched on it before when we were talking about how so many people are having direct experiences of the divine energy themselves.
Yeah.
And I remember I was speaking in front of a group last month, and I was talking about the book, and the people were really into the subject matter, and we were having a great discussion. And I told them that story that I told you earlier about my experiences with kind of awakening to the spirit energy. And one gentleman in the audience said, "Well, the one thing that I would have to say is that, you know, you're an exception. I don't think most other people in the room would have these experiences or could do what you did." And that was why I exactly wrote the book, to tell people that that's not true. We're all capable of having a transformative experience in our lives, and that's the real meaning of salvation. The salvation isn't so much salvation isn't really sort of saving our souls so that we go to heaven in the afterlife. I think the Gnostic concept of salvation was that we can experience salvation here and now in this body, and that salvation is exactly what we've been talking about, which is awakening with an enlightened experience so we understand our true nature in the universe. And instead of when we do have these spiritual experiences, it's just so powerful because, you know, all of a sudden, all these things that rule our lives, family, institutional religion, government, science, all these things that we give our power over to, we suddenly realize that we're so much more, and we're not just little cogs in the whole wheel, that we can make tremendous contributions individually to other human beings, to the planet and so forth, because we have this great spiritual power within us. But you know what? To most people out there who haven't experienced it, it just sounds like words and theory. You really do have to be a seeker, and if you do seek with a fervent heart, and you are open to the idea, or at least the intellectual concept, that there is a spirit energy out there that contains information that can really help our lives and transform us, that there is something out there to connect with. If you seek for it and you take that path, eventually you will find it and you will connect with it. And the day you connect with it, it no longer is a theory. It's a fact of your life. And I can't tell people how empowering that feeling is. I mean, it's the fuel that sent me in the direction that I've gone and that allowed me to write this book. I couldn't have written this book without having all those experiences behind me, because if I was doing this just from an intellectual basis, from a bookish kind of thing where, you know, I read about all these things and I put together a little interesting story, I never could have stuck with it all these years. This was something that really came, again, from direct experiences I've had. So the message that I have out there is that everybody can have these transformative spiritual experiences. It's a matter of studying, seeking. And when your mind is always working in that direction, your heart is in particular, not just your mind, but your heart and mind together are working in that direction, then the law of attraction kicks in. Just like I used to meet these shamans and bush doctors when I traveled around, who helped affirm to me that the things that I went through weren't fantasy and imagination. That was part of my growing process. I had to validate what I'd already seen a couple times in order to think, wow, it's like shaking the dust from your eyes. I wasn't really dreaming this stuff. I wasn't fantasizing it. This stuff really happened. It was real. And other people have had the experience. That I'm here to be a witness with this book and testify to that, and to sort of guide people in the direction that they can set off on that path for themselves.
Well, that's wonderful. I don't know that, you know, I'm grappling right now with this very issue, in that I'm noticing, you know, we're all awake at varying degrees, and we're all asleep at varying degrees, you know, in our lives. And so, I mean, that's unfortunately, that's the world, and we live in a world based on fragmentation and separation. And so I see so much fragmentation in people. And there are, but I have to say this, Peter, there are people who are spiritual teachers who are really out there for the money and are disseminating a lot of information, but have not actually gone through taken the next step and actually can actually quantify that they have actually experienced what they're talking about. So I don't find a lot of spiritual teachers in that position. There are a lot of people who are out there who have a good talk, you know, and you know, but I don't. You know, what I sometimes see is that, and we're all learning. And I think that sometimes writing a book can be the catalyst for you to actually do your healing. You know what I mean? So just because you write a book does not mean that you have the experience behind you. It could actually be what may precipitate your healing as well. But, so, you know, I mean, that's just my experience of what I'm experiencing. The other point I wanted to make was that this gentleman that you had, who had stood up and said, you know, you're rare. I mean, I get that a lot myself. For me, it was I needed to do my whole journey before I went out and taught. You know, and I still continue to do my journey, but the only way that I can continue my journey is by teaching others. Right? That's the trajectory I'm on. Because for me to sit around and continue to do my own healing, well, that's there's not a whole lot to be doing on my own. It's more me being in the position of a teacher and learning through those I heal.
That's a very important concept, because I could have spent a life doing one-on-one intuitive medical readings, and of course, each of those would be a reaffirmation that I'm in contact with spirit, and there would have been gratification in that in terms of helping people. But I kind of grew beyond that, and I really came to the conclusion that I don't do those individual readings anymore. I haven't done them in many years, and I felt that I had a way to communicate with more people on a mass basis and not just touch those people who were predisposed towards some form of healing or spiritual seeking. And there's a lot of them out there. I wanted to reach people who weren't even thinking about these things.
Right,
and
no, that's beautiful.
I felt the best way to do that would not be through, if I did another spiritual self-help book, and there's lots of people doing them out there who are much better than I am at doing it. You can go in any metaphysical bookstore and get Deepak Chopra and Carolyn Mace and, all Wayne Dyer and all the authors that we know of that, that do a great job in the self-help field. The people who really aren't thinking in that direction won't pick up those kind of books, but they will read a novel like this, which is a page-turning novel that probably would be a Hollywood movie someday. It's great movie potential, just because it's just so exciting, and the mystery and the suspense and the thriller aspects of just the plot line itself attracts a lot of people. I've had plenty of people pick up this book who are spiritual. I guess I could say spiritually clueless. They just don't really think in those terms.
Right.
And they love the book itself, but they do glean something at whatever level they're ready. They do glean something of the spiritual message in there. It does get them to think, to rethink, and I'm not the only one. Then they will hear other things in the atmosphere around here, and then it becomes a cumulative thing where, the more this stuff piles on, the more things you hear about, the more you get curious, and the more people try and seek. So I really wanted to touch a broader audience than just the sort of spiritual groups that I would be hanging around with or I would meet with. I wanted to get out there, and I wanted to have something that would reach the general public, and I think through the vehicle of this book, that theme through the test marketing I did and the types of comments I'm getting back from different people, that is exactly happening. It's really appealing to a broad spectrum of people, and that's very gratifying to me, because that's what I wanted to do.
Right, that's great. I really like that. I know when you and I initially spoke, I was like, I don't know about this fiction thing, because, we in the spiritual community, we're so engrossed in this. But now, in reading your book and going over your material and stuff like that, I really shifted my perspective on that, and I think that you're right. I think it's really smart of you to try to awaken the masses, because that is so needed.
Well, one of the things is, as human beings, we all tend to fall into forms of orthodoxy. You get the scientists, who are always cutting down religion, and yet science has its own orthodoxy. And if you go against that orthodoxy, you'll be persecuted just as well as you would have been Galileo back with the Catholic Church a few centuries ago. The spiritual community is the same way. The spiritual community gets certain notions, and they start using certain buzzwords like fundamentalist Christians will, okay? They start to develop their own dogmas and their own terminology, their own precepts. And if you don't quite hit them in the way that they're used to, they look at you with a little bit of a jaundiced eye. So one of the things I'm always wary about is orthodoxy in any form. Because when we start getting orthodox and dogmatic about our beliefs, then we really started to limit our vision and narrow our vision and limit ourselves. And we really don't want to do that. So I think the main thing is we have to keep an open mind. That's why I hear a lot of people in the spiritual community put down fundamentalist Christianity. And, my attitude about that is, listen, yes, there may be intolerance there. There may be a narrowness of thinking there sometimes, and a fear of going outside the box and maybe looking at something differently. But by the same token, you have to understand that the people there think a lot about God, and they are spiritually seeking. They're seeking their own way. Now, they may be seeking in a way that somebody else might think is limiting. But the point is if they're on that path and their eyes are looking towards God in some form, I believe eventually in this life or some other lifetime, they will evolve towards a broader perspective of thinking. So, you know, you might think of it as spirituality 101, and they can go on and graduate. But I think the key thing is, no matter what our sphere is, spiritual, fundamentalist, scientific, whatever, you got to really keep an open mind about things. And remember, Einstein made his greatest discoveries by thinking backwards. He would see a solution, and then he would work his way backwards into a theory. He'd really visualize the solution. Einstein had an incredibly flexible mind, and he also happened to believe in God as a scientist, which a lot of scientists now, I mean, you mentioned the word God, and it's like, you could get drummed out. It's sort of like being a conservative on a political campus. Okay, we don't have any room for that if you're conservative, because political campuses aren't conservative. Well, in the scientific world, they don't have any room for God talk, because, you know, God's a dirty word in the scientific world. It's just too bad that we get so inflexible in our thinking that, you know, we can't hold on to our own beliefs and understand that we're at a certain point along the road, and they may be at a certain point along the road, and we're going to change and they're going to change. I mean, things that I firmly thought, you know, were really set in my mind, I've come 180 degrees around in the last few years. So, what I've learned is, it's very hard to look at anything and say it is the truth. It's the best truth we know at this stage in our journey, and it could very well be superseded by a newer and a higher truth. So let's try and keep open-minded and flexible when we, you know, talk with other people from different orientations.
Oh, for sure. No, that's great. And the truth resides within you. There's a wisdom that resides within each and every one of us. It's just waiting to be awakened, you know, truly.
I completely believe that.
Yeah, and that the wisdom that resides within each and every one of us, it's a universal language, right? It's a language that we all speak, although we may speak it a little differently, but it's universal. I truly believe that.
I believe it's true, because if you take a look at mystics all around the ancient world, whether they're coming from an Indian culture, Sumerian, Middle Eastern, or whatever, the information they brought back from the higher dimensions that they would penetrate is startlingly similar. Just the way the Edgar Cayce story of creation, which he told in his psychic meditations prior to the Gnostic Gospels ever being discovered, is so close to what the Gnostics were saying. And how could that be? Well, it's because this isn't fantasy we're talking about. This is a very advanced spiritual penetration that's almost scientific in a way, and the information that it brings back, because it is universal, will have a commonality, you know, despite what culture it appears in.
Right, which is beautiful. I have a question here. Do you think this this book will help the overall human condition that the indigenous people of Africa face?
I think it's more universal than that. I don't tend to think of it as African or European or anything else. I just tend to think of it as human. I think this book can help any human in any circumstance by causing us to get outside of the box that we've been put in terms of, you know, our religious upbringing and other forms of control, but other forms of regimented thinking, let's say, have led us down a certain path. And this is a book that encourages us to take spiritual responsibility for ourselves. And that means you got to work at it. You know, one of the reasons that churches became so successful, why did the Gnostics, who are these brilliant mystics that brought back this great information, and they were a very strong stream of early Christianity. Early Christianity had two main streams: Orthodox Christianity, which is pretty much what we've got today, and the mystical or Gnostic Christianity. And the Gnostics were so strong, at one point, Valentinus, who was a Gnostic, almost was elected pope, narrowly missed becoming the pope, back in the, I think it was around the third century. Why did the Gnostics lose out, and why were they eradicated by the Orthodox Church? Well, think of it for a second. For most people, we're so busy engaged in the struggle for survival, emotional, physical survival, whatnot, putting food on the table, you know, our jobs, putting the kids through college. We're so engaged in that, we take very little responsibility for our spiritual growth and our spiritual life. And it's a lot easier to go to a church, say confession, and get absolved by a priest and go home and feel good. And it always was that way in the human condition. If a spiritual path is work, I mean, you know that. I think probably any of your listeners who are on that path know that. It's very difficult, and you go through dark nights of the soul, and you go through periods of doubt, and a lot of different types of things, a lot of synchronicities happen to you when you're on this path, and sometimes they're not all the best things in the world. It is a path that is difficult, but it's also extraordinarily rewarding. And I think what this book encourages people to do is that, you know, to say, look, here's the end goal of this, and this is really worth working towards, and it's really worth studying, and it's really worth meditating on, and it's really worth seeing that the things in here can happen to you as well as to the characters in the book, or as well as things that have happened to you or to me, Karis, on our own spiritual journey. So I think in that regard, it takes a universal dimension that I wouldn't limit to Africa, Europe, Asia, or any other geographic location or people or culture.
That's good. That's wonderful. Now, just to finish up, Peter, can you just give us a brief overview on how does Pope Annalisa treat Christianity, Catholicism, and the Christian story?
It's not a Catholic book. The Catholic Church is a vehicle, a very interesting vehicle, I think, for telling a tale about where we have evolved as a Western culture, because it's been so entwined with our Western culture. And in that sense, it's done both good things and bad things. And there's rarely anything that's totally black and white. The church has done some pretty horrendous things. Church has also done some good things. And the church has, it's been a repository of a vast amount of intellectual knowledge. I mean, some of these guys in the Vatican are absolutely, you know, brilliant people, and of course they have access to these texts that you know, scholars can only dream of. So it's not a book that bashes Christianity or Catholicism at all. In fact, Annalisa becomes the Pope. She says at some point in the book, that work that I do, I must do through the Church. And it's really more of taking this institution of the Church, which is so embodied in our own religious and social history, and not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, but saying, let's see how it can transform from within. Let's take along this idea of the line that, you know, spirituality 101 and graduating, let's take what we've been handed down in terms of Catholicism or Christianity, and see how it can be transformed from within to become a very you know, positive force in the world. And that is much of what is going on in the book here. And the book also is very much about reconciliation. It talks a lot about conflicts between Christianity and the Muslim world and the Islamic world and other religious conflicts. But what the book is really about is spirit transcending religion. And at the end of the day, the reconciliations that are achieved in the book are achieved by essentially moving humanity towards a higher spiritual level. So I think that probably pretty much sums up the attitude of the book towards Christianity and Catholicism, and I think it's a fair one.
Okay, great. No, that's super. And originally I had thought it kind of read like the Da Vinci Code, and I think that you probably get a lot of people asking you that question. So what would you have to say to that with that regard?
Well, look, there's superficial similarities between Pope Annalisa and the Da Vinci Code. I mean, they both take place, you know, a lot of the action takes place within the confines of the Vatican, and it sort of has a backdrop of Christian or Catholic religious history. And I guess the only other circumstance that would be a parallel is that the Da Vinci Code has a central theme in there that Mary Magdalene was Jesus's consort, and that they had children. This is the old bloodline theory, and essentially that's what the whole thing of the Da Vinci Code was. In the Da Vinci Code, the discovery was that Mary Magdalene was the Holy Grail, which was the receptacle of Jesus's children. Well, Mary Magdalene plays a very important part in the trilogy, some in Pope Annalisa to begin with, much more so in the second book, The 13th Disciple, which is really about Mary Magdalene, but it's a very different perspective. My feeling about the whole thing of Jesus and Magdalene being married and having children, I don't even go there. First of all, it may or may not have happened, but even if it did, it just has no importance other than historical curiosity. It has no relevance to the human condition at all. In the First Souls and in Pope Annalisa, Mary Magdalene is also the Holy Grail, but of something far more important than Jesus' children or just bearing children. She is the receptacle of Jesus' sacred knowledge, this oral teaching, this sacred knowledge that was almost lost and destroyed by Orthodox Christianity. You remember, even in the Bible itself, it said that Jesus spoke in parables to the masses, but to the disciples, he gave the mysteries. There's also a document called Secret Mark, where one of the early church fathers, Clement of Alexandria, essentially says that there was a secret teaching, and it was written by Luke, who was Saint Luke of the Bible, who was a secretary to the Apostle Peter, and that Luke compiled these secret esoteric teachings of Jesus, and that they were not given out to the masses. They were only taught to the more spiritually advanced. So you have not only the Gnostics saying that there was a secret teaching, but you also have even the Orthodox, the early Orthodox fathers before, you know, things went too far along the way and they had to cover their tracks, admitting that there was a secret teaching. And Mary Magdalene was the receptacle of this teaching. So I think that's something far more important in terms of women, in terms of Magdalene's role, is being the bearer of that sacred knowledge than being the bearer of Jesus' children.
Wow, that's beautiful. That's beautiful, and a wonderful way to finish up our time together, Peter. I thank you so much for coming on the show. Now, if people want to purchase your book, how can they go about doing that? Could you give us your website and how they could contact you?
Yeah, sure. The website is Pope Annalisa. That's one word, PopeAnnalisa.com. The website has a lot of information about the book and the thematic background of all these topics we've been talking about. And the official publication date of the book is June 1st. It is currently available right now. You can order it in a bookstore. It may not be in the shelves until sometime after June 1st, but it's on the distributor's databases over there, so that if you go into the bookstores, you can order it. There is currently on Amazon.com, there's a paperback version. I don't know if it's going to be there that long. In order to really sort of get a fire and get this book popularized, I'm hoping people would purchase the hardcover version, because that's the one where you sort of get credit for in the sales world and in the publishing world. And the book is kind of at that critical juncture now where it really needs that kind of push to take off. So I'm hoping that when the listeners go in, they might ask for the hardcover version. And it should be available through most major bookstores right now if you just ask them to look it up under Pope Annalisa. And hopefully it'll be in the shelf sometime after June 1st.
Great. And we do have it listed on your profile page on for those that are going to be listening in the archive, so at least they can see the copy and know what they're looking for when they go in the store.
Great.
Or purchase it on through Amazon, because we have a link for them to do that there. So I want to thank you, Peter, for coming on the show on Mother's Day today. What a wonderful day to be talking about this wonderful feminine energy and raising the consciousness of humanity to integrate that aspect of themselves. And that is the key. It's the integration of the male and female as one in both men and women. And so that's beautiful. We are coming into that place of wholeness, you know, and that's the place in which we are moving our consciousness. So thank you so much for coming on. And you, mister, are pioneering a very provocative story in terms of having the first black woman pope, and I believe that you're going to be very, very successful, and I'm glad to have been on the beginning of your journey in terms of having you come on the show and sharing with our listeners your wisdom and insights. So thank you.
Well, Karis, thank you for inviting me. Thanks for all the great questions, and I hope your listeners enjoyed it. I certainly enjoyed speaking with you tonight, and maybe we'll come back again sometime.
Oh, for sure. You're more than welcome. And yeah, I wish you all the best. I think you've got something really solid here, and I look forward to seeing you on your journey.
Well, thank you very much, and good evening.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.